Nick Van Bloss, a young English musician, has Tourette's of considerable severity. He reckons that he has nearly 40,000 tics a day, including his obsessions, imitations, counting compulsions, compulsive touchings, and so on. But when he plays the piano, he shows scarcely a hint of this. I asked him to play some Bach for me. Bach is his favorite composer, and Glenn Gould is his hero, and he did so without interruption. The only tics he displayed, a mild facial grimacing, were far less disturbing, I thought, than Gould's famous humming. Van Bloss developed his first, rather explosive symptoms when he was 7, attracting savage ridicule and bullying from his schoolmates. There was no intermission in his ticking until his family got a piano, and this was to transform his life. "Suddenly, I had a piano," he writes in his memoir, Busybody, "and, as if handed to me on a plate, I found my love. When I played, my tics almost seemed to disappear. It was like a miracle. I would tick, gyrate, and verbally explode all day at school, get home exhausted from it all, and run to the piano and play for as long as I could, not only because I loved the sounds I was making, but primarily because when I played, I didn't tick. I got time off from the ticky normality that had become me." When I discussed this with Van Bloss, he spoke of it partly in terms of energy. It was not, he felt, that his Tourette's had disappeared, but that it was now being harnessed and focused, and specifically, that his compulsions to touch could now be consummated by touching the keys of the piano. I was simultaneously feeding and fueling my Tourette's by giving it a thing it so craved. "Touch," he writes. "The piano appealed to my fingers, provided touch heaven for me. 88 keys, all sitting and waiting for my needy little fingers." Van Bloss feels that his repertoire of tics was fully developed by the age of 16 and has changed little in the years since, but he is now far more accepting of them, for he recognizes that his Tourette's, in a paradoxical way, plays an essential role in his piano playing. I found it especially fascinating to listen to a conversation between Nick Van Bloss and Tobias Picker, the distinguished composer, who also has Tourette's, to listen to them compare notes on the role that Tourette's has played in their music-making. Picker also has many tics, but when he is composing or playing the piano or conducting, his tics disappear. I have watched him as he sits almost motionless for hours, orchestrating one of his etudes for piano at his computer. The tics may have vanished, but this does not mean that the Tourette's itself has gone. Picker feels, on the contrary, that his Tourette's enters into his creative imagination, contributing to his music, but also being shaped and modulated by it. "I live my life controlled by Tourette's," he said to me, "but I use music to control it. I have harnessed its energy. I play with it, manipulate it, trick it, mimic it, taunt it, explore it, exploit it in every possible way." His newest piano concerto, in some sections, is full of turbulent, agitated whirls and twirls. But Picker writes in every mode, the dreamy and tranquil no less than the violent and stormy, and moves from one mood to another with consummate ease. Tourette's brings out in stark form questions of will and determination. Who orders what? Who pushes whom around? To what extent are people with Tourette's controlled by a sovereign I, a complex, self-aware, intentional self, or by impulses and feelings at lower levels in the brain-mind? Similar questions are brought up by musical hallucinations and brainworms and varied forms of quasi-automatic echoing and imitation. Normally, we are not aware of what goes on in our brains, of the innumerable agencies and forces inside us, that lie outside or below the level of conscious experience, and perhaps this is just as well. Life becomes more complicated, sometimes unbearably so, for people with eruptive tics or obsessions or hallucinations, forced into daily incessant contact with rebellious and autonomous mechanisms in their own brains. They face a special challenge. But they may also, if the tics or hallucinations are not too overwhelming, achieve a sort of self-knowledge or reconciliation that may significantly enrich them in their strange fight, the double lives they lead. Chapter 19. Keeping Time, Rhythm and Movement. 1974 was an eventful year for me in several respects, for it was a year in which I had musical hallucinations twice, attacks of amusia twice, and the complex musicomotor events I would later describe in A Leg to Stand On. I had had a bad climbing accident on a mountain in Norway, tearing off the quadriceps tendon of my left leg, as well as doing some nerve damage to it. The leg was useless, and I had to find a way to get down the mountain before nightfall. I soon discovered that the best strategy was to row myself down, somewhat as paraplegics do in their wheelchairs. At first I found this difficult and awkward, but soon I fell into a rhythm, accompanied by a sort of marching or rowing song, sometimes the vulgar boatmen's song, with a strong heave on each beat. Before this, I had muscled myself along. Now, with the beat, I was musicked along. Without this synchronization of music and movement, the auditory with the motor, I could never have made my way down the mountain. And somehow, with this internal rhythm and music, it felt much less like a grim, anxious struggle. I was rescued halfway down the mountain and taken to a hospital, where my leg was examined, x-rayed, and put into a cast, and then I was flown to England, where, 48 hours after the injury, I had surgery to repair the tendon. Nerve and other tissue damage had to await a natural healing, of course, and there was a 14-day period, therefore, in which I could not use the leg. Indeed, it seemed to be both numb and paralyzed, and not really even a part of me. On the 15th day, when it was judged safe for me to put weight on the leg, I found that I had, strangely, forgotten how to walk. There was only a sort of pseudo-walking, conscious, cautious, unreal, step by step. I would make steps that were too large or too small, and on a couple of occasions managed to cross the left leg in front of the right one, almost tripping on it. The natural, unthinking spontaneity, the automaticity of walking, completely evaded me until again, suddenly, music came to my aid. I had been given a cassette of Mendelssohn's Violin Concerto in E minor. This was the only music I had, and I had been playing it for 2 weeks almost non-stop. Now, suddenly, as I was standing, the concerto started to play itself with intense vividness in my mind. In this moment, the natural rhythm and melody of walking came back to me, and along with this the feeling of my leg as alive, as part of me once again. I suddenly remembered how to walk. The neural systems underlying the newly rediscovered skill of walking were still fragile and easily exhausted, and after half a minute or so of fluent walking, the inner music, the vividly imagined violin concerto, stopped suddenly, as if the needle had been lifted from a record. In that instant, walking stopped too. Then, after I had rested for a while, the music and motion came back to me, again in tandem. After my accident, I wondered if this sort of experience occurred with others, and barely a month had gone by when I saw a patient at a nursing home, an old lady with an apparently paralyzed and useless left leg. She had suffered a complex hip fracture, followed by surgery and many weeks of immobility in a cast. Surgery had been successful, but her leg remained strangely inert and useless. Though there was no clear anatomical or neurological reason for this, she told me she could not imagine how to move the leg. Had the leg ever been able to move since the injury? I asked her. She thought for a moment and said yes, it had, once. It had kept time at a Christmas concert, by itself, when an Irish jig was being played. This was enough. It indicated that whatever was going on or not going on in her nervous system, music could act as an activator, a de-inhibitor. We bombarded her with dance tunes, especially Irish jigs, and saw for ourselves how her leg responded. It took several months, for the leg had become very atrophied. Nevertheless, with music, she was not only able to delight in her own quasi-automatic motor responses, which soon included walking, but to extract from them an ability to make whatever discrete, voluntary movements she desired. She had reclaimed her leg and her sensory motor system in full. Hippocrates, more than 2,000 years ago, wrote of people who fell and broke their hips, which in those pre-surgical days demanded months of bandaging and immobility to let the bones knit. In such cases, he wrote, the imagination is subdued, and the patient cannot remember how to stand or walk. With the advent of functional brain imaging, the neural basis of such subduing has been clarified. There may be inhibition or deactivation not only peripherally in the nerve elements of the damaged tendons and muscles, and perhaps in the spinal cord, but also centrally in the body image, the mapping or representation of the body in the brain. A.R. Luria, in a letter to me, once referred to this as the central resonances of a peripheral injury. The affected limb may lose its place in the body image, while the rest of the body's representation then expands to fill the vacancy. If this happens, the limb is not only rendered functionless, it no longer seems to belong to one at all. Moving such a limb feels like moving an inanimate object. Another system must be brought in, and it is clear that music, above all else, can kickstart a damaged or inhibited motor system into action again. Whether it was the singing of a simple rowing song on the mountain, or the vivid imagining of the Mendelssohn violin concerto when I stood up in the hospital, the rhythm or beat of the music was crucial for me, as it was for my patient with the fractured hip. Was it just the rhythm or beat of the music, or was the melody with its movement, its momentum, also important? Beyond the repetitive motions of walking and dancing, music may allow an ability to organize, to follow intricate sequences, or to hold great volumes of information in mind. This is the narrative or mnemonic power of music. It was very clear with my patient, Dr. P., who had lost the ability to recognize or identify even common objects, though he could see perfectly well. He may have suffered from an early and primarily visual form of Alzheimer's. He was unable to recognize a glove or a flower when I handed it to him, and he once mistook his own wife for a hat. His condition was almost totally disabling, but he discovered that he could perform the needs and tasks of the day if they were organized in song. His wife explained to me, I put all his usual clothes out in all the usual places, and he dresses without difficulty, singing to himself. He does everything singing to himself, but if he is interrupted and loses the thread, he comes to a complete stop, doesn't know his clothes or his own body. He sings all the time, eating songs, dressing songs, bathing songs, everything. He can't do anything unless he makes it a song. Patients with frontal lobe damage may also lose the ability to carry out a complex chain of actions, to dress, for example. Here, music can be very useful as a mnemonic or a narrative, in effect, a series of commands or promptings in the form of rhyme or a song, as in the childhood song, This Old Man. It is similar with some autistic people and with severely retarded people, who may be unable to perform fairly simple sequences, involving perhaps four or five movements or procedures, but who can often do these tasks perfectly well if they set them to music. Music has the power to embed sequences, and to do this when other forms of organization, including verbal forms, fail. Every culture has songs and rhymes to help children learn the alphabet, numbers, and other lists. Even as adults, we are limited in our ability to memorize series or to hold them in mind unless we use mnemonic devices or patterns, and the most powerful of these devices are rhyme, meter, and song. We may have to sing the ABC song internally to remember the alphabet, or imagine Tom Lehrer's song to remember all the chemical elements. For someone who is gifted musically, a huge amount of information can be retained in this way, consciously or unconsciously. The composer Ernst Toch, his grandson Lawrence Weschler tells me, could readily hold in his mind a very long string of numbers after a single hearing, and he did this by converting the string of numbers into a tune, a melody he shaped corresponding to the numbers. A neurobiology professor recounted to me the story of an extraordinary student, Jay, whose answers on one exam sounded suspiciously familiar. The professor wrote, "A few sentences later, I thought, no wonder I like her answers. She's quoting my lectures word for word." There was also a question on the exam that she answered with a direct quote from the textbook. The next day, I called Jay into my office to have a talk with her about cheating and plagiarism. But something did not add up. Jay did not seem like a cheater. She seemed totally lacking in guile. So as she walked into my office, what came into my head and out of my mouth was the question, "Jay, do you have a photographic memory?" She answered very excitedly, "Yes, sort of like that. I can remember anything as long as I put it to music." She then sang back to me from memory whole portions of my lectures, and very prettily too. I was flabbergasted. While this student is, like Toch, extraordinarily gifted, all of us use the power of music in this way, and setting words to music, especially in pre-literate cultures, has played a huge role in relation to the oral traditions of poetry, storytelling, liturgy, and prayer. Entire books can be held in memory. The Iliad and the Odyssey famously could be recited at length because, like ballads, they had rhythm and rhyme. How much such recitation depends on musical rhythm and how much purely on linguistic rhyming is difficult to tell, but these are surely related. Both rhyme and rhythm derive from the Greek, carrying the conjoined meanings of measure, motion, and stream. An articulate stream, a melody or prosody, is necessary to carry one along, and this is something that unites language and music and may underlie their perhaps common origins. The powers of reproduction and recitation may be achieved with very little idea of meaning. One has to wonder how much Martin, my retarded savant patient, understood of the 2,000 cantatas and operas he knew by heart, or how much Gloria Lenhoff, a woman with Williams syndrome and an IQ under 60, actually comprehends the thousands of arias in 35 languages which she can sing from memory. The embedding of words, skills, or sequences in melody and meter is uniquely human. The usefulness of such an ability to recall large amounts of information, especially in a pre-literate culture, is surely one reason why musical abilities have flourished in our species. The relationship between motor and auditory systems has been investigated by asking people to tap to a beat, or, where commands cannot be given verbally, as with infants or animals, by observing whether there is any spontaneous synchronization of movement with an external musical beat. Ani Patel at the Neurosciences Institute has recently pointed out that in every culture there is some form of music with a regular beat, a periodic pulse that affords temporal coordination between performers and elicits synchronized motor response from listeners. This linking of auditory and motor systems seems universal in humans and shows itself spontaneously early in life. But, as Patel wrote in his 2006 paper, there is not a single report of an animal being trained to tap, peck, or move in synchrony with an auditory beat. No doubt many pet lovers will dispute this notion, and indeed many animals, from the Lipizzaner horses of the Spanish Riding School of Vienna to performing circus animals, appear to dance to music. It is not clear whether they are doing so, or are responding to subtle visual or tactile cues from the humans around them. In Thailand, elephants have been trained to strike percussion instruments and play on their own. Intrigued by accounts of the Thai elephant orchestra, Patel and Everson made careful measurements and video recordings of the elephant's performances. They found, as they reported in a 2006 paper, that an elephant could play a percussion instrument, a large drum, with a highly stable tempo. Indeed, a tempo more stable than most humans could achieve. But the other elephants in the orchestra struck their instruments, cymbals, gongs, etc., in seeming disregard of each other, without any hint of synchronization to the auditory beat of the drum elephant. The rather mechanical term entrainment is sometimes used in regard to the human tendency to keep time, to make motor responses to rhythm. But research has shown that so-called responses to rhythm actually precede the external beat. We anticipate the beat. We get rhythmic patterns as soon as we hear them, and we establish internal models or templates of them. These internal templates are astonishingly precise and stable. As Daniel Levitin and Perry Cook have shown, humans have very accurate memories for tempo and rhythm. Galileo famously exemplified this in his experiments timing the descent of objects as they rolled down inclined planes. Having no accurate watches or clocks to go by, he timed each trial by humming tunes to himself, and this allowed him to get results with an accuracy far beyond that of the timepieces of his era. Chen, Zatori, and Penhune in Montreal have studied the ability of human beings to keep time, to follow a beat, and they have used functional brain imaging to visualize how this is reflected in the brain. Not surprisingly, they found activation of the motor cortex and of subcortical systems in the basal ganglia and cerebellum when subjects tapped or made other movements in response to music. What is more remarkable is their finding that listening to music or imagining it, even without any overt movement or keeping time, activates motor cortex and subcortical motor systems too. Thus, the imagination of music, of rhythm, may be as potent, neurally, as actually listening to it. Keeping time, physically and mentally, depends, as Chen and her colleagues have found, on interactions between the auditory and the dorsal premotor cortex, and it is only in the human brain that a functional connection between these two cortical areas exists. Crucially, these sensory and motor activations are precisely integrated with each other. Rhythm, in this sense, the integration of sound and movement, can play a great role in coordinating and invigorating basic locomotor movement. I found this when I was rowing myself down the mountain to the Volga Boatmen song, and when the Mendelssohn enabled me to walk again. Musical rhythm can be valuable, similarly, to athletes, as the physician, Melanie Kinnison, a competitive cyclist and triathlete, observed to me. I have been a competitive cyclist for a number of years, and have always been interested in the individual time trial, an event that pits the rider against the clock only. The effort required to excel at this event is painful. I often listen to music while I am training, and noticed fairly early that some pieces of music were particularly uplifting and inspired a high level of effort. One day in the early stages of an important time trial event, a few bars of the overture to Orpheus in the Underworld by Offenbach started playing in my head. This was wonderful. It stimulated my performance, settled my cadence at just the right tempo, and synchronized my physical efforts with my breathing. Time collapsed. I was truly in the zone, and for the first time in my life, I was sorry to see the finish line. My time was a personal best. Now, all of Kinnison's competitive cycling is accompanied by bracing musical imagery, usually from operatic overtures. Many athletes have had similar experiences. I have found it similar with swimming. In swimming freestyle, one usually kicks in groups of three, with a strong kick to every arm stroke, followed by two softer kicks. Sometimes I count these to myself as I swim. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. But then this conscious counting gives way to music with a similar beat. On long, leisurely swims, Strauss waltzes tend to play in my mind, synchronizing all my movements, providing an automatism and accuracy beyond anything I can achieve with conscious counting. Leibniz said of music that it is counting, but counting unconsciously, and this is precisely what swimming to Strauss is all about. The fact that rhythm, in this special sense of combining movement and sound, appears spontaneously in human children, but not in any other primate, forces one to reflect on its phylogenetic origins. It has often been suggested that music did not evolve on its own, but emerged as a byproduct of other capacities with more obvious adaptive significance, such as speech. Did speech, in fact, precede music, as Steven Pinker suggests? Did song precede speech, as Darwin thought? Or did both develop simultaneously, as Mithun proposes? How can this dispute be resolved? Patel asks in his 2006 paper. One approach is to determine whether there are fundamental aspects of music cognition which cannot be explained as byproducts or secondary uses of more clearly adaptive abilities. Musical rhythm, with its regular pulse, he points out, is very unlike the irregular stressed syllables of speech. The perception and synchronization of beat, Patel feels, is an aspect of rhythm that appears to be unique to music and cannot be explained as a byproduct of linguistic rhythm. It seems probable, he concludes, that musical rhythm evolved independently of speech. There is certainly a universal and unconscious propensity to impose a rhythm, even when one hears a series of identical sounds at constant intervals. John Everson, a neuroscientist and an avid drummer, has pointed this out. We tend to hear the sound of a digital clock, for example, as tick-tock, tick-tock, even though it is actually tick, 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 tick. Anyone who has been subjected to the monotonous volleys of noise from the oscillating magnetic fields that bombard one during an MRI has probably had a similar experience. Sometimes the deafening ticks of the machine seem to organize themselves in a waltz-like rhythm of threes, sometimes in groups of four or five. It is as if the brain has to impose a pattern of its own, even if there is no objective pattern present. This can be true not only with patterns in time, but with tonal patterns too. We tend to add a sort of melody to the sound of a train. There is a wonderful example of this, raised to the level of art, in Arthur Honegger's Pacific 231, or to hear melodies in other mechanical noises. One friend of mine feels that the hum of her refrigerator has a Haydnish quality. And for some people, with musical hallucinations, these may first appear as an elaboration of a mechanical noise, as with Dwight Mamlock and Michael Sundu. Leo Rangel, another man with musical hallucinations, commented on how elementary rhythmic sounds, for him, became songs or jingles. And for Solomon R., in Chapter 17, rhythmic body movements gave rise to a sing-song cantillation, their minds giving meaning to what would otherwise be a meaningless sound or movement. Anthony Storr, in his excellent book Music and the Mind, stresses that in all societies, a primary function of music is collective and communal, to bring and bind people together. People sing together and dance together in every culture, and one can imagine them having done so around the first fires, 100,000 years ago. This primal role of music is to some extent lost today, when we have a special class of composers and performers, with the rest of us often reduced to passive listening. We have to go to a concert, or a church, or a musical festival, to re-experience music as a social activity, to recapture the collective excitement and bonding of music. In such a situation, music is a communal experience, and there seems to be, in some sense, an actual binding or marriage of nervous systems, a neurogamy, to use a word the early mesmerists favored. The binding is accomplished by rhythm, not only heard but internalized, identically, in all who are present. Rhythm turns listeners into participants, makes listening active and motoric, and synchronizes the brains and minds, and, since emotion is always intertwined with music, the hearts of all who participate. It is very difficult to remain detached, to resist being drawn into the rhythm of chanting or dancing. I observed this when I took my patient, Greg F., to a Grateful Dead concert at Madison Square Garden in 1991. Greg's story is related in The Last Hippie, in An Anthropologist on Mars. The music, the rhythm, got everyone within seconds. I saw the whole vast arena in motion with the music, 18,000 people dancing, transported, every nervous system there synchronized to the music. Greg had had a massive tumor which had wiped out his memory and much of his spontaneity. He had been amnesic and inert, barely responsive except to music for many years. But he was taken over and animated by the thumping, pounding excitement of the crowd around him, the rhythmic clapping and chanting, and soon he, too, began shouting the name of one of his favorite songs, Tobacco Road, Tobacco Road. I say I observed all this, but I found myself unable to remain a detached observer. I realized that I, too, was moving, stamping, clapping with the music, and soon lost all my usual diffidence and inhibition and joined the crowd in communal dancing. Augustine, in his Confessions, described how, on one occasion, he went to a gladiatorial show with an aloof young man who professed disgust and contempt at the scenes before him. But when the crowd grew excited and began a rhythmic roaring and stamping, the young man could resist no longer and joined in as orgiastically as everyone else. I have had similar experiences in religious contexts, even though I am largely lacking in religious faith or feeling. When I was a boy, I loved Simchas Torah, the rejoicing of the law, which was celebrated, even in our normally sober Orthodox congregation, with ecstatic chanting and dancing round and round the synagogue. While in many cases religious practice now tends to be somewhat decorous and detached, there is evidence that religious practices began with communal chanting and dancing, often of an ecstatic kind, and not infrequently culminating in states of trance. The almost irresistible power of rhythm is evident in many other contexts. In marching, it serves both to entrain and coordinate movement, and to whip up a collective and perhaps martial excitement. We see this not only with military music and war drums, but also with the slow, solemn rhythm of a funeral march. We see it with work songs of every sort, rhythmic songs that probably arose with the beginnings of agriculture, when tilling the soil, hoeing, and threshing all required the combined and synchronized efforts of a group of people. Rhythm and its entrainment of movement, and often emotion, its power to move people, in both senses of the word, may well have had a crucial cultural and economic function in human evolution, bringing people together, producing a sense of collectivity and community. This, indeed, is central to the vision of cultural evolution presented by Merlin Donald in his astonishing 1991 book, Origins of the Modern Mind, and in many subsequent papers. An essential feature of Donald's vision is his concept that human evolution moved from the episodic life of apes to a mimetic culture, and that this flourished and lasted for tens, perhaps hundreds of thousands of years, before language and conceptual thinking evolved. Donald proposes that mimesis, the power to represent emotions, external events, or stories, using only gesture and posture, movement and sound, but not language, is still the bedrock of human culture today. He sees rhythm as having a unique role in relation to mimesis. Rhythm is an integrative mimetic skill, related to both vocal and visuomotor mimesis. Rhythmic ability is supramodal, that is, once a rhythm is established, it may be played out with any motor modality, including the hands, feet, mouth, or the whole body. It is apparently self-reinforcing, in the way that perceptual exploration and motor play are self-reinforcing. Rhythm is, in a sense, the quintessential mimetic skill. Rhythmic games are widespread among human children, and there are few, if any, human cultures that have not employed rhythm as an expressive device. Donald goes further, seeing rhythmic skill as a prerequisite not only for all music, but for all sorts of non-verbal activities, from the simple rhythmic patterns of agricultural life to the most complex social and ritual behaviors. Neuroscientists sometimes speak of the binding problem, the process by which different perceptions or aspects of perception are bound together and unified. What enables us, for example, to bind together the sight, sound, smell, and emotions aroused by the sight of a jaguar? Such binding in the nervous system is accomplished by rapid, synchronized firing of nerve cells in different parts of the brain. Just as rapid neuronal oscillations bind together different functional parts within the brain and nervous system, so rhythm binds together the individual nervous systems of a human community. Chapter 20. Kinetic Melody, Parkinson's Disease and Music Therapy. William Harvey, writing about animal movement in 1628, called it the silent music of the body. Similar metaphors are often used by neurologists who speak of normal movement as having a naturalness and fluency, a kinetic melody. This smooth, graceful flow of movement is compromised in Parkinsonism and some other disorders, and neurologists speak here of kinetic stutter. When we walk, our steps emerge in a rhythmical stream, a flow that is automatic and self-organizing. In Parkinsonism, this normal happy automatism is gone. Though I was born into a musical household and music has been important to me personally from my earliest years, I did not really encounter music in a clinical context until 1966, when I started work at Beth Abraham Hospital, a chronic care hospital for patients in the Bronx. Here, my attention was immediately drawn to a number of strangely immobile, sometimes entranced-looking patients, the post-encephalitic survivors I was later to write about in Awakenings. There were nearly 80 of them at the time. I saw them in the lobby, in the corridors, as well as on the wards, sometimes in strange postures, absolutely motionless, frozen in a trance-like state. A few of these patients, rather than being frozen, were in the opposite state, one of almost continuous driven activity, all their movements accelerated, excessive and explosive. All of them, I discovered, were victims of encephalitis lethargica, the epidemic sleeping sickness that swept the globe just after World War I, and some had been in this frozen state since they had entered the hospital 40 or more years before. In 1966, there was no medication of any use to these patients, no medication at least for their frozenness, their Parkinsonian motionlessness. And yet, it was common knowledge among the nurses and staff that these patients could move on occasion, with an ease and grace that seemed to belie their Parkinsonism, and that the most potent occasioner of such movement was, in fact, music. Typically, these post-encephalitic patients, like people with ordinary Parkinsonism, could not easily initiate anything, and yet often they were able to respond. Many could catch and return a ball if it was thrown, and almost all of them tended to respond in some way to music. Some of them could not initiate a single step, but could be drawn into dancing and could dance fluidly. Some could scarcely utter a syllable. Their voices, when they could speak, lacked tone, lacked force, were almost spectral. But these patients were able to sing, on occasion, loudly and clearly, with full vocal force and a normal range of expressiveness and tone. Other patients could walk and talk, but only in a jerky, broken way, without a steady tempo, and sometimes with incontinent accelerations. With such patients, music could modulate the stream of movement or speech, giving them the steadiness and control they so lacked. Though music therapy was hardly a profession in the 1960s, Beth Abraham, most unusually, had its own music therapist, a dynamo called Kitty Stiles. It was only when she died in her late 90s that I realized she must already have been over 80 when I met her, but she had the vitality of a much younger person. Kitty had a special feeling for our post-encephalitic patients, and in the decades before drugs such as L-DOPA were available, it was only Kitty and her music which could bring them to life. Indeed, when we came to make a documentary film about these patients in 1973, the film's director, Duncan Dallas, immediately asked me, "Can I meet the music therapist? She seems to be the most important person around here." So she was, in the days before L-DOPA, and so she continued to be when the effects of L-DOPA became, in many patients, erratic and unstable. While the power of music has been known for millennia, the idea of formal music therapy arose only during the First and Second World Wars, when large numbers of wounded soldiers were gathered in veterans' hospitals, and it was found that their pain and misery, and even, seemingly, some of their physiological responses, pulse rates, blood pressure, and so on, could be improved by music. Doctors and nurses in many veterans' hospitals started to invite musicians to come and play for their patients, and musicians were only too happy to bring music to the dreadful wards of the wounded. But it was soon evident that enthusiasm and generosity were not enough. Some professional training was needed as well. The first formal music therapy program was set up in 1944 at Michigan State University, and the National Association for Music Therapy was formed in 1950. But music therapy remained, for the next quarter of a century, scarcely recognized. I do not know whether Kitty Stiles, our music therapist at Beth Abraham, had any formal training or was licensed as a music therapist, but she had an immense intuitive gift for divining what could get patients going, however regressed or disabled they might appear. Working with individual patients calls upon empathy and personal interaction as much as any formal therapy, and Kitty was very skilled at this. She was also an audacious improviser and very playful, both on the keyboard and in life. Without this, I suspect, many of her efforts would have been futile. I once invited the poet W. H. Auden to one of Kitty's sessions, and he was amazed by the instant transformations which music could effect. They reminded him of an aphorism of the German romantic writer Novalis: "Every disease is a musical problem. Every cure is a musical solution." This seemed almost literally to be the case with these profoundly Parkinsonian patients. Parkinsonism is usually called a movement disorder, though when it is severe, it is not only movement that is affected, but the flow of perception, thought, and feeling as well. The disorder of flow can take many forms. Sometimes, as the term kinetic stutter implies, there is not a smooth flow of movement, but brokenness, jerkiness, starts and stops instead. Parkinsonian stutter, like verbal stuttering, can respond beautifully to the rhythm and flow of music, as long as the music is of the right kind, and the right kind is unique for every patient. For one of my post-encephalitic patients, Francis D., music was as powerful as any drug. One minute I would see her compressed, clenched, and blocked, or else jerking, ticking, and jabbering, like a sort of human time bomb. The next minute, if we played music for her, all of these explosive obstructive phenomena would disappear, replaced by a blissful ease and flow of movement, as Mrs. D., suddenly freed of her automatisms, would smilingly conduct the music or rise and dance to it. But it was necessary for her that the music be legato. Staccato, percussive music might have a bizarre counter-effect, causing her to jump and jerk helplessly with the beat, like a mechanical doll or marionette. In general, the right music for Parkinsonian patients is not only legato, but has a well-defined rhythm. If, on the other hand, the rhythm is too loud, dominating, or intrusive, patients may find themselves helplessly driven or entrained by it. The power of music in Parkinsonism is not, however, dependent on familiarity or even enjoyment, though in general music works best if it is both familiar and liked. Another patient, Edith T., a former music teacher, spoke of her need for music. She said that she had become graceless with the onset of Parkinsonism, that her movements had become wooden, mechanical, like a robot or doll. She had lost her former naturalness and musicality of movement. In short, she said, she had been unmusicked by her Parkinsonism. But when she found herself stuck or frozen, even the imagining of music might restore the power of action to her. Now, as she put it, she could dance out of the frame, the flat frozen landscape in which she was trapped, and move freely and gracefully. It was like suddenly remembering myself, my own living tune. But then, just as suddenly, the inner music would cease, and she would fall once again into the abyss of Parkinsonism. Equally dramatic, and perhaps in some way analogous, was Edith's ability to use, to share, other people's ambulatory abilities. She could easily and automatically walk with another person, falling into their rhythm, their tempo, sharing their kinetic melody. But the moment they stopped, she would stop too. The movements and perceptions of people with Parkinsonism are often too fast or too slow, though they may not be aware of this. They may be able to infer it only when they compare themselves to clocks or to other people. The neurologist William Goody described this in his book Time and the Nervous System. An observer may note how slowed a Parkinsonian's movements are, but the patient will say, "My own movements seem normal to me unless I see how long they take by looking at a clock. The clock on the wall of the ward seems to be going exceptionally fast." Goody wrote of the sometimes enormous disparities such patients can show between personal time and clock time. I discussed this and other disorders of time in my 2004 essay, Speed. But if music is present, its tempo and speed take precedence over the Parkinsonism and allow Parkinsonian patients to return, while the music lasts, to their own rate of moving, that which was natural for them before their illness. Music indeed resists all attempts at hurrying or slowing and imposes its own tempo. I saw this recently at a recital by the eminent and now Parkinsonian composer and conductor Lucas Foss. He rocketed almost uncontrollably to the piano, but once there, played a Chopin nocturne with exquisite control and timing and grace, only to festinate once again as soon as the music ended. This power of music was invaluable with one extraordinary post-encephalitic patient, Ed M., whose movements were too fast on the right side of his body and too slow on the left side. We could not find any good way to medicate him, for whatever improved one side would worsen the other. But he loved music, and he had a small organ in his room. With this, and this only, when he sat down and played, he could bring his two hands, his two sides, together in unison and synchrony. A fundamental problem in Parkinsonism is the inability to initiate movement spontaneously. Parkinsonian patients are always getting stuck or frozen. Normally, there is a virtually instantaneous commensuration between our intentions and the subcortical machinery, the basal ganglia especially, that allows their automatic inaction. Gerald Edelman, in The Remembered Present, refers to the basal ganglia, along with the cerebellum and hippocampus, as the organs of succession. But it is the basal ganglia especially which are damaged in Parkinsonism. If the damage is very severe, the Parkinsonian may be reduced to virtual immobility and silence, not paralyzed, but in a sense locked in, unable by himself to initiate any movement, and yet perfectly able to respond to certain stimuli. The Parkinsonian is stuck, so to speak, in a subcortical box, and can only emerge from this, as Luria brings out, with the help of an outside stimulus. Thus, Parkinsonian patients can be called into action, sometimes by something as simple as throwing them a ball, though once they catch the ball or throw it back, they will freeze again. To enjoy any real sense of freedom, a longer release, they need something which can last over time, and the most potent unlocker here is music. This was very clear with Rosalie B., a post-encephalitic lady who tended to remain transfixed for hours each day, completely motionless, frozen, usually with one finger stuck to her spectacles. If one walked her down the hallway, she would walk in a passive wooden way, with her finger still stuck to her spectacles. But she was very musical and loved to play the piano. As soon as she sat down on the piano bench, her stuck hand came down to the keyboard, and she would play with ease and fluency. Her face, usually frozen in an inexpressive Parkinsonian mask, full of expression and feeling. Music liberated her from her Parkinsonism for a time, and not only playing music, but imagining it. Rosalie knew all of Chopin by heart, and we had only to say Opus 49 to see her whole body, posture, and expression change, her Parkinsonism vanishing as the F minor fantasy played itself in her mind. Her EEG, too, would become normal at such times. If Rosalie could imagine music so effectively as to normalize her EEG, why did she not do this all the while? Why did she remain helpless and transfixed for most of the day? What she lacked, as all patients with Parkinsonism lack to some extent, was not the power of imagination, but the power to initiate mental or physical action. Thus, by saying Opus 49, we initiated matters, and all she had to do was respond. But without such a cue or stimulus, nothing would have happened. Ivan Vaughan, a Cambridge psychologist who developed Parkinson's disease, wrote a memoir about living with the disease, and Jonathan Miller directed a 1984 BBC documentary, Ivan, broadcast as part of the Horizon series based on this. In both the book and the film, Ivan describes a variety of ingenious, indirect stratagems for getting himself going, which he could not do by sheer will. Thus, for example, he would allow his eyes to wander when he woke up, until he caught sight of a tree painted on the wall by his bed. This would act as a stimulus, in effect saying, "Climb me," and by imagining himself climbing, Ivan could climb out of bed, a simple act which he was unable to do directly. When I came to Beth Abraham in 1966, music was chiefly provided by the indefatigable Kitty Stiles, who spent dozens of hours each week at the hospital. Sometimes there was music from a record player or radio, though Kitty herself seemed to have a stimulating power of her own. Recorded music was not portable at this time. Battery-powered radios and tape recorders were still large and heavy. Now, of course, everything has changed, and we can have hundreds of tunes on an iPod the size and weight of a matchbook. While the extreme availability of music may have its own dangers, I wonder whether brain worms or musical hallucinations are more common now. This availability is an unmitigated boon for those with Parkinsonism. While most of the patients I see are the severely disabled residents of chronic care hospitals and nursing homes, I get letters from many Parkinsonian people who are still relatively independent and living at home, perhaps with a little help. Recently, Carolina Yaney, a psychologist in Albuquerque, wrote to tell me about her mother, who, because of Parkinson's disease, had had great difficulty walking. "I made up a goofy little song," the daughter wrote, "called Walkin' Mama, that included a finger-snapping beat. I have a rotten voice, but she liked hearing it. She would play it with the tape recorder hooked on her waistband and earphones. It really seemed to help her navigate around the house." Nietzsche was intensely interested throughout his life in the relationship of art, and especially music, to physiology. He spoke of its tonic effect, its power of arousing the nervous system in a general way, especially during states of physiological and psychological depression. He was himself often depressed, physiologically and psychologically, by severe migraines. He also spoke of the dynamic or propulsive powers of music, its ability to elicit, to drive, and to regulate movement. Rhythm, he felt, could propel and articulate the stream of movement and the stream of emotion and thought, which he saw as no less dynamic or motoric than the purely muscular. And rhythmic vitality and exuberance, he thought, expressed itself most naturally in the form of dance. He called his own philosophizing dancing in chains, and thought the strongly rhythmic music of Bizet as ideally suited to this. He would often take his notebook to Bizet concerts. He wrote, "Bizet makes me a better philosopher." I had read Nietzsche's notes on physiology and art as a student many years before, but his concise and brilliant formulations in The Will to Power came alive for me only when I came to Beth Abraham and saw the extraordinary powers of music with our post-encephalitic patients, its power to awaken them at every level, to alertness when they were lethargic, to normal movements when they were frozen, and, most uncannily, to vivid emotions and memories, fantasies, whole identities which were, for the most part, unavailable to them. Music did everything that L-DOPA, still in the future, was subsequently to do, and more, but only for the brief span while it lasted, and perhaps for a few minutes afterwards. Metaphorically, it was like auditory dopamine, a prosthesis for the damaged basal ganglia. It is music that the Parkinsonian needs, for only music, which is rigorous yet spacious, sinuous and alive, can evoke responses that are equally so. And he needs not only the metrical structure of rhythm and the free movement of melody, its contours and trajectories, its ups and downs, its tensions and relaxations, but the will and intentionality of music to allow him to regain the freedom of his own kinetic melody. Chapter 21. Phantom Fingers. The Case of the One-Armed Pianist. Some years ago I received a letter from Erna Otten, a piano student who had once studied with a Viennese pianist, Paul Wittgenstein. Wittgenstein, she explained, had lost his right arm in World War I. I had many occasions to see how involved his right stump was whenever we went over the fingering for a new composition. He told me many times that I should trust his choice of fingering, because he felt every finger of his right hand. At times I had to sit very quietly while he would close his eyes, and his stump would move constantly in an agitated manner. This was many years after the loss of his arm. As a postscript, she added, his finger choice was always the best. The varied phenomena of phantom limbs were first explored in detail by the physician Silas Weir Mitchell during the Civil War, when great numbers of veterans came to the many hospitals established to treat their wounds, including what was known as the Stump Hospital in Philadelphia. Weir Mitchell, a novelist as well as a neurologist, was fascinated by the descriptions he received from these soldiers, and he was the first to take the phenomenon of phantom limbs seriously. Prior to this, they had been regarded as purely in the mind, apparitions conjured up by loss and grief, like the apparitions of recently deceased children or parents. Weir Mitchell showed that the appearance of a phantom limb occurred in every patient who had an amputation, and he surmised that it was a sort of image or memory of the lost limb, a persistent neural representation of the limb in the brain. He first described the phenomenon in his 1866 short story, The Case of George Dedlow, published in the Atlantic Monthly. It was only some years later, in his 1872 book, Injuries of Nerves and Their Consequences, that he addressed his fellow physicians on the subject. The majority of amputees are able to will a movement, and apparently, to themselves, execute it more or less effectively. The certainty with which these patients describe their phantom motions and their confidence as to the place assumed by the parts moved are truly remarkable. The effect is apt to excite twitching in the stump. In some cases, the muscles which act on the hand are absent altogether, Yet in these cases there is fully as clear and definite a consciousness of the movement of the fingers and of their change of positions as in cases where the muscles to the hand are partially preserved. Such phantom memories and images occur to some extent in almost all amputees and may last for decades. Although the phantoms may be intrusive or even painful, especially if the limb was painful immediately before amputation, they may also be of great service to the amputee, enabling him to learn how to move a prosthetic limb, or, in the case of Wittgenstein, determine the fingering of a piano piece. Before Weir Mitchell's account, phantom limbs were regarded as purely psychic hallucinations conjured up by bereavement, mourning, or yearning, comparable to the apparitions of loved ones that mourners may experience for some weeks after their loss. Weir Mitchell was the first to show that these phantom limbs were real, neurological constructs dependent on the integrity of the brain, the spinal cord, and the remaining proximal portions of the sensory and motor nerves to the limb, and that their sensation and motions were accompanied by excitation in all of these. That such an excitation in fact occurred during phantom motion was proved for him by its overflow into movements of the stump. Recent neurophysiology has confirmed Weir Mitchell's hypothesis that the entire sensory ideational motor unit is activated in phantom motions. Farsin Hamzai et al. In Germany described in 2001 how there can be striking functional reorganization in the cortex after the amputation of an arm, in particular cortical disinhibition and enlargement of the excitable area of the stump. We know that movement and sensation continue to be represented in the cortex when the limb is physically lost, and Hamzai et al.'s findings suggest that the missing limb's representation may be conserved and concentrated in the now enlarged, hyperexcitable stump area of the cortex. This might explain why, as Otten noted, Wittgenstein's stump moved in an agitated manner when he played with his phantom arm. The last few decades have seen great advances in neuroscience and biomechanical engineering, advances particularly pertinent to the Wittgenstein phenomenon, and engineers are developing highly sophisticated artificial limbs with delicate muscles, amplification of nerve impulses, servo mechanisms, and so on, that can be married to the still intact portion of the limb and allow phantom motions to be turned into real ones. The presence of strong phantom sensations and of willed phantom movements is indeed essential to the success of such bionic limbs. Thus it seems possible in the not-so-far-off future that a one-armed pianist may be fitted with such a limb and with it be able to play the piano again. One wonders what Paul Wittgenstein or his brother would have thought of such a development. Ludwig Wittgenstein's final book speaks of our first grounding certainty as being the certainty of our bodies. Indeed, his opening proposition is, "If you do know that here is one hand, we'll grant you all the rest." Although Wittgenstein's On Certainty is well known to have been written in response to the ideas of the analytic philosopher G. E. Moore, one must wonder, too, whether the strange matter of his brother's hand, a phantom indeed, but real, effectual and certain, did not also play a part in inciting Wittgenstein's thinking. Chapter 22. Athletes of the Small Muscles. Musicians' Dystonia. In 1997, I received a letter from a young Italian violinist who related to me how he had started playing the violin when he was six, had gone on to the conservatory, and then embarked on a career as a concert violinist. But then, at the age of 23, he started to experience peculiar difficulties with his left hand, difficulties which, he wrote, have cut short my career and my life. Playing pieces of a certain degree of difficulty, he continued, I found that the middle finger was not responding to my commands, and imperceptibly tended to shift from the position where I wanted to place it on the string, affecting the pitch. He consulted a physician, one of many he was to consult in the years to come, and was told that the overwork of this hand had caused an inflammation of the nerves. He was advised to rest and desist from playing for 3 months, but this, he found, had no effect. Indeed, when he resumed playing, the problem had become worse, and the strange difficulty in controlling finger movement had spread to the fourth and fifth fingers. Now only the index finger remained unaffected. It was only when he played the violin, he stressed, that his fingers disobeyed him. They functioned normally in all other activities. He went on to describe an odyssey of 8 years in which he had consulted physicians, physiotherapists, psychiatrists, therapists, and healers of every sort all over Europe. He had been given many diagnoses: strained muscles, inflamed tendons, trapped nerves. He had undergone carpal tunnel surgery, faradization of nerves, myelograms, MRIs, and a great deal of intensive physical therapy and psychotherapy, all to no avail. Now, at 31, he felt that he could no longer maintain any hope of resuming his career. He had a deep sense of bewilderment, too. He felt that his condition was organic, that in some way it came from his brain, and that if there were any peripheral factors, such as nerve injuries, these had at most played a subsidiary part. He had heard, he wrote, of other performers with similar problems. With almost all of them, a seemingly trivial problem had grown steadily more severe, resisted all attempts at treatment, and ended performance careers. I had received a number of similar letters over the years, and had always referred my correspondence to a neurologist colleague, Frank Wilson, who had written an important early paper in 1989, Acquisition and Loss of Skilled Movement in Musicians. As a result, Wilson and I had been corresponding about so-called focal dystonia in musicians for some time. The problems my Italian correspondent described were not, indeed, anything new. Such problems have been observed for centuries, not only in players of musical instruments, but in a variety of other activities that demanded continuous, rapid movements of the hands or other parts of the body over long periods. In 1833, Sir Charles Bell, the famous anatomist, gave a detailed description of the problems that could affect the hands of people who wrote incessantly, such as clerks in government offices. He later called this Scrivener's palsy, though it was already well recognized among such writers, who called it writer's cramp. Gowers, in his 1888 Manual of Diseases of the Nervous System, devoted 20 close-packed pages to discussing writer's cramp and other occupation neuroses, the generic term he adopted for a group of maladies in which certain symptoms are excited by the attempt to perform some oft-repeated muscular action, commonly one that is involved in the occupation of the sufferer. Among clerks who suffer writer's cramp, Gowers said, lawyers' clerks constitute an undue proportion. This is no doubt due to the cramped style in which they commonly write. On the other hand, writer's cramp is practically unknown among those who write more and under higher pressure than any other class, shorthand writers. Gowers attributed this freedom to their using a very free style of writing, generally from the shoulder, which is also adopted by them in longhand writing. Gowers spoke of the susceptibility of pianists and violinists to their own occupation neuroses. Other provocative occupations included those of painters, harpists, artificial flower makers, turners, watchmakers, knitters, engravers, masons, compositors, enamelers, cigarette makers, shoemakers, milkers, money counters, and zither players, a veritable tally of Victorian occupations. Gowers did not see these task-specific problems as benign. The disease, when well developed, is one in which the prognosis is always uncertain and often unfavorable. Interestingly, at a time when such symptoms were either ascribed to peripheral problems with muscles, tendons, or nerves, or seen as hysterical or mental, Gowers did not feel satisfied with either explanation, though he allowed that these factors could play a subsidiary role. He insisted, rather, that these occupational neuroses had an origin in the brain. One reason for this thought was the fact that, though different parts of the body could be afflicted, all the provocative occupations involved rapid, repetitive movements of small muscles. Another was the conjunction of inhibitory features, such as unresponsiveness or paralysis, with excitatory ones, abnormal movements or spasms, which increased the more one fought against the inhibition. These considerations disposed Gowers to see occupation neuroses as disorders of motor control in the brain, disorders he thought might involve the motor cortex. The functions of the basal ganglia were unknown at this time. Once occupation neuroses developed, there was little chance of continuing in the same occupation or profession. But despite the mysterious nature and crippling consequences of this condition, remarkably little attention was paid to it medically for almost a century. Though it was well known in the world of performing musicians that this dread condition could lie in wait for anyone, perhaps 1 in 100 musicians would be affected at some point in their career, a natural reserve, even secrecy, prevailed. To acknowledge an occupation-related cramp was close to professional suicide. It would be understood that one would have to give up performing and become a teacher, a conductor, perhaps a composer instead. Richard J. Lederman of the Cleveland Clinic has proposed that this may be what happened to Schumann, who developed a strange hand condition in his pianistic days, which, in desperation, he attempted to treat himself, and perhaps rendered irreparable by the use of a finger-stretching device. Not until the 1980s was this veil of secrecy finally torn away, with great courage, by two virtuoso pianists, Gary Graffman and Leon Fleischer. Their stories were remarkably similar. Fleischer, like Graffman, had been a child prodigy and one of the preeminent pianists in the world from his teenage years. In 1963, at the age of 36, he found the fourth and fifth fingers of his right hand starting to curl under his hand when he played. Fleischer fought against this and continued to play, but the more he fought, the worse the spasm became. A year later, he was forced to give up performing. In 1981, in an interview with Jennifer Dunning in the New York Times, Fleischer gave a precise and graphic description of the problems that had put a stop to his performance, including the years of misdiagnosis and sometimes mistreatment he had received. Not the least of his problems when seeking treatment was not being believed, for his symptoms came on only with piano playing, and very few doctors had a piano in their office. Fleischer's public acknowledgement of his condition came soon after Graffman acknowledged his own problem in 1981, and this spurred other musicians to admit that they, too, had been having similar problems. It also stimulated the first medical and scientific attention to the problem in almost a century.